Hello, and welcome to the reading of Southern Magazines. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Jane Clark, and we're going to be reading today from Garden and Gun Magazine, the April-May issue. And our first article from the section of the magazine entitled Talk of the South, Music by Matt Hendrickson, Voice from the Mountain. West Virginia native Sierra Farrell is Americana's next big star. It's another stormy day in Nashville, a city that's seen its fair share of turbulent weather over the past few years. Last December, another brigade of tornadoes raked Middle Tennessee, including one that Sierra Farrell says almost hit her house. She has a unique way of coping. I call it tomato weather. Come again? Tomato weather. It just sounds better than tornado weather. She's not wrong. And tornadoes haven't been the only whirlwind in Farrell's life. Since the release of her Rounder Records debut, Long Time Coming, in 2021, the Charleston, West Virginia native has become one of Music City's most buzzed about artists. She was nominated for Artist of the Year at last fall's Americana Music Awards, has opened for Dave Matthews Band, and recorded a duet, Holy Roller, with breakout country superstar Zach Bryan, whom she will join on the road for Bryan's stadium tour this summer. Out this spring, Farrell's anticipated new album, Trail of Flowers, finds the 35-year-old multi-hyphenate, along with singing and guitar. She's fluent in the fiddle. Veering between her ragtime jazz, folk balladry, country rock, and bluegrass, all behind her seasoned, singular voice, which sounds like something that would come out of a 1920s phonograph. American Dreaming is a sweeping epic, with Farrell's delicate vocals giving way to a mellow groove that builds to a soaring peak. Dollar Bill Barr offers an enchanting dabble in Beatles rainbow pop that Farrell executes flawlessly, and she embraces her love of old-time music with a cover of Fiddlin' Arthur Smith's Chitlin' Cookin' Time in Cheatham County, featuring Chris Scruggs, Earl's grandson, on guitar and lap steel. Sierra's voice is so beautiful, so technically and soulfully special, that it seems to be a fully formed thing without any tinkering, says Seth Avett of the Avett Brothers, for whom Farrell has opened. There's such an obvious comparison between her and where she's from, the grit and blue collar, but also this heavenly beauty. A sense of sadness and nostalgia infuses Trail of Flowers, intertwining on the album's first single, Fox Hunt, a ghostly holler stomper that harkens back to a simpler way of life. It's about doing something as raw as going out in the woods and hunting for yourself, for people you love, Farrell says, as her teacup Yorkie, Mr. Baker, barks in the background. It's got that old-time feel which I always love, because it was people just getting together and playing songs that are hundreds of years old. Farrell went through a difficult upbringing in Charleston, raised by a single mother struggling with poverty. She frequently found solace in music, whether singing karaoke to Shania Twain, playing clarinet in her high school band, or singing gospel songs as she learned to play guitar. In her early 20s, she split West Virginia, riding trains and busking around the country before landing in New Orleans, where she played on the streets in various combinations, including with an all-female ragtime group called Ladies on the Rag. Tired of street singing's volatile nature and worried about paying her bills, Farrell headed to Nashville around 2014. She self-released two albums and played constantly, catching the attention of Rounder Records. On stage, she has established herself as one of Americana's great performers. At her 2022 New Year's Eve extravaganza in Nashville, she wore a rhinestone-studded Manuel suit and dramatic makeup while dangling over the crowd, joined by a sword swallower, lassoing experts, aerialists, and magicians. It was a campy thrill, and while Farrell has indulged her love of theatrics, she's also spoken openly about her struggles with depression, canceling a string of shows last year to focus on her mental health. "I've always been a super dramatic person," she says, "but I'm finding that playing the characters on stage is a safe space for me to just lean into and try to forget about the casualties of the world." An admitted worrier, Farrell recognizes that many of her songs have a melancholy streak. I'm trying to write happy songs. And though she loves playing, she's wary about the trappings of fame. "Some people take pictures of me and I look nice, but they don't know that I've cried three times that day." Once again, music will serve as therapy. She plans on keeping the costumes and makeup for her upcoming headlining shows, and she plans to play many sets of old-time and traditional songs with her band gathered around a single microphone. "I know that I have an effect on people, and I'm a healer in a sense," she says. "By helping my fans heal and live, I'm also healing myself." And that concludes our article, Voice from the Mountain, by Matt Hendrickson. And our next article, from the Talk of the South section, an interview with John Berendt, who wrote Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. 30 Years Past Midnight is the title of the article, by C.J. Lotz Diego. John Berendt reflects on his Savannah masterwork. In the late 80s, a Savannahian pulled the visiting journalist John Berendt aside. "As far as Savannah's concerned," she told him, "being a writer and being from New York is a deadly combination." "I understand," he replied, "but I will let everyone know that I'm writing a book. I have no intention of being secretive." That 1994 nonfiction work, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which Clint Eastwood turned into a film, soon became known in Savannah as simply The Book. The personality of this city propels each page. Creaking, art-filled mansions, unforgettable characters like the Lady Chablis, Chatham artillery punch-fueled parties, and the unraveling of a murder that somehow, in some way, involves just about everyone. A new musical based on Midnight is now in the works, and the current publisher, Vintage Knopf Doubleday, recently released an anniversary edition that includes a new afterword by Berendt, who is now the book's sole living main character. And the interview begins, "How did Midnight come to be?" "I didn't have an advance or show the book to anyone while I was working on it. When I took it to my agent, she said it was too local. I didn't argue because I didn't want to cause a ruckus, but I could have tossed back how Flannery O'Connor said that all literature is local. I got a new agent who took it to 5 publishers. Every one of them wanted it, and we had a bidding war. Random House hired a local photographer, Jack Lee. I told them, you can't do better than Bonaventure Cemetery. Jack went there and found the bird girl. It was not a tombstone. It was an ornament in a family plot. When I saw that picture, it was just a fuzzy photocopy, not as sharp as the final, but I knew immediately that it was a brilliant cover, mysterious and striking. Random House sent the manuscript to news outlets, and one was Good Morning America. The person who read it loved it and decided that I would be the guest host in Savannah. The book hit the bestseller list, and things snowballed. I went from unknown author to one thing leading to another, and it was a total surprise. And the interviewer asked, the Lady Chablis, was she the first person that you heard say, spill the tea? I caught her saying, pour the tea. And I think she meant like, come on, tell me what's going on. She was being secretive and fun. When the Lady Chablis died in 2016, the now deceased defense attorney, Sonny Saylor, said to me, well, now that Chablis has died, I'm the last living major character. And I said, Sonny, I'm still alive. Another major character is the city of Savannah itself. When I've gone back, so much has utterly changed. I don't know what's new or most of the restaurants, but I hear the Crystal Beer Parlor is still a very popular place downtown and that they still make great hamburgers. Savannah is very close to my heart, and I hope that they continue to protect it. When I went back, I was amazed at all kinds of things, all kinds of big buildings shooting up. But most of them are ringing the historical district or out of sight below the bluff along the river. I just hope they keep the Oglethorpe plan intact. The design with the squares is the gem that makes Savannah special. What is your favorite small town in the South these days? Bluffton, South Carolina. The atmosphere, the look of it, and the people. Is there anything that you wish you would have included in the book? I shoehorned so much in there, I don't have any regrets about anything. Otherwise, I would be tortured. And that concludes our interview with John Berendt, 30 Years Past Midnight by Cide Lopes Diego. And our next article, Traditions. The Circle Holds, written by Donovan McAbee. A beloved Southern folk song uplifts across generations. I have no clue what the upstairs neighbors must have thought. I wouldn't call what I was doing at the time singing. More like a semi-melodious howling while strumming a guitar. Back then, I correlated serenity with volume, and at 23, I was nothing if not sincere. That spring, I had taken a semester off from seminary and was spending my days on Long Island with my terminally ill mother, reading William Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, and George Herbert. I was trying my hand at writing, too. Poems, songs, and short stories rushed out with urgency. Those months of anticipatory grief became a strange limbo. I tried to savor each moment, but death cast a long shadow. When the doctors found Mama's initial tumor under her arm, they thought it might be breast cancer, a diagnosis that she had always feared. A needled biopsy proved inconclusive, but within a month the tumor had expanded from the size of a quarter to a mass 5 or 6 times larger. Only after the oncologist removed it did we know how bad the situation was. Melanoma. So now I was living with her during her second experimental treatment. She worked in fashion in New York City, where she had moved years after she and my father divorced, and as caregiver, I wanted to help her keep her job as long as she wanted. She toiled 12 and 13-hour days, taking the train back and forth. When she came home, she looked pale, a ghost. While she was gone, between cleaning the house and buying groceries, I bellowed the same songs to bolster my spirits. Come thou fount of every blessing, its old melody as grounding as the lyrics. Jerry Jeff Walker's Gettin' By, with Walker's signature wit, Gettin' By on Gettin' By, which most days I was hardly doing. And the song that buoyed me more than any other, that folk classic, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? The lyrics both soothed and troubled, taking me to where I'd soon be, like the narrator, watching the undertaker come to carry my mother away. I needed to hear the voice of someone who'd been there, at the window, aching for their parent, at the graveside even, where sorrow can't be hidden and must only be endured. Originally a hymn written in 1907, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, entered the vernacular of the South by way of A.P. Carter, the Virginia-born founder of the Carter Family Country Act and the songwriter of such tunes as My Clinch Mountain Home. In folk tradition, Carter often adapted other melodies and gave them new lyrics, as he did with the song that he originally retitled, Can the Circle Be Unbroken? Folk songs, like grief, contain truths broadly felt, and yet both have elements that inflect differently based on a person's experiences. Perhaps this fusion of the personal and the universal is why songs in our folk tradition often have so many lyrics and so many variations. These songs belong to all of us, even as they belong to each of us. The tune to Circle, for example, appears on Harry Smith's 1952 compilation, Anthology of American Folk Music, as a 1928 recording of Elders McIntosh and Edwards Sanctified Singers performing a song titled, Since I Laid My Burden Down. Their version begins with the words, Glory, glory, hallelujah, since I laid my burden down. Taj Mahal opens with those lyrics on the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's 2002 Will the Circle Be Unbroken, Volume 3, before singing the Carter lyrics alongside Alison Krauss and Doc Watson. On 1989's Volume 2, Nitty Gritty's Jimmy Ibbotson pens a new verse, one that honors the ways Mother Maybelle A.P. Carter's guitar-picking sister-in-law and Johnny Cash's mother-in-law has taught the hymns of faith. Hear the angels singing along, Ibbotson invites, for grief and loss don't have the final word. The experimental treatment brought us a year of good times with Mama, but when the melanoma returned, it did so with a fierceness. She was living back in our home state of South Carolina at that point, and my brother Sean and I checked her into the cancer wing of a Spartanburg hospital. Her liver, they told us, was full of tumors. As dark as those days were, we still found sweet moments in the hospital. Old jokes and memories recounted. The doctors gave Mama boatloads of Marinol, the artificial marijuana derivative that's supposed to make cancer patients hungry, like a hyped-up version of the munchies. We got a kick out of Mama's hankering for Chick-fil-A biscuits, Krispy Kreme donuts, and mint mocha frappuccinos. Melanoma could not abscond with all our joy. When she died, though, I felt bereft, lost. I knew I wanted to speak at Mama's funeral and to sing, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," as it had offered such comfort already. But when I got up front with my guitar, I could hardly make it through the song. I stumbled through the verses, mangled chords. Then the congregation joined me in the chorus, and suddenly I didn't feel so alone. There we were, gathering to mourn, our voices becoming one. When I sing that song now, I usually close my eyes because it's become as much a prayer as anything. In that darkness, I'm not just listening to my own voice. I'm listening for where the song resides, close to my heart, where it has remained a balm when someone else I love is carried away. When a cousin left us before his time 2 winters ago, when a dear friend died of cancer. Then in 2022, my family and I happened to be visiting my father in South Carolina from our home in Nashville when he began to feel nauseated. His health had been precarious all my life, partly due to a form of rheumatoid arthritis, so that it was not out of the ordinary. When he'd remained in bed for 24 hours, I checked his blood pressure. It was very low. He resisted an ambulance, but we called one anyway. Something similar had happened twice in the previous year. Surely, we thought, this would end as it had before. Dad would get rehydrated, his blood pressure would rise and stabilize, and he'd be home in a day or two. When I arrived at the ER, he was in excruciating pain. The cardiologist worried that he had had another heart attack. While this shook me again, I wasn't totally unnerved. Dad had experienced heart attacks before. An aortic intramural hematoma, a laundry list of other comorbidities related to arthritis. He'd had quadruple bypass surgery. He had gone into cardiac arrest at my Nashville home in 2016, and I performed CPR on him. He coded 5 times but survived. The doctors used the word like miracle. Dad had come close to death so many times that it seemed he'd always pull through. The doctors finally decided he must be bleeding internally. They asked my brother Darren and me to leave so they could run more tests. I told Dad I loved him and that we'd be outside, and a moment later I heard him scream, then the heart monitor flatlined. The team started CPR and defibrillation. I contacted family and friends asking for prayers. I prayed myself. I cried. I listened as they tried to bring Dad back. They could get his heart started, but it wouldn't keep beating. They stopped. He was gone. Every time I practiced "Will the Circle Be Unbroken" for Daddy's funeral, I broke down with the guitar in my hands. At times, I left his house to get away, to drive through the foothills. As I curved around roads where my memory filled in the peach trees long gone, I'd sing the song, a lump the size of a pit forming in my throat, preventing me from getting through the verses. I'd invited a friend, a Baptist minister, to lead the hymns for the service, and he and his wife agreed to sing along with me. If I faltered, they could keep the song going. And so after I had preached Dad's funeral sermon, I draped the guitar over my shoulder and began changing the lyrics, like so many before me, to make the song my own. I was standing by my window on one cold and cloudy day when I saw that hearse come a-rollin' for to carry my daddy away. My eyes closed. I expected to lose the lyrics, raw as I felt, but the prayer of the song cradled me as it had in those days before Mama's death. My friend and his wife joined in that prayer, their voices lifting with mine. the congregation's voices then united with ours in the chorus. All of us longing for our broken circle of friends and family to be made whole again. And for a moment, it was. And that concludes our article, The Circle Holes, by Donovan McVie. Our next article is entitled, Petal Pushers, What's in Season, by Jenny Everett. Everyone screams for Big Spoon Creamery's honeysuckle ice cream. While walking her rescue dog, Charlie, around her Birmingham, Alabama neighborhood on a spring morning, Jerry Martha O'Hara passed a big honeysuckle bush bursting with blooms. One deep inhale of the aromatic blossoms, and she knew just what to use for her next ice cream flavor. I first experienced honeysuckle as a child, picking the blooming flowers and eating the nectar, says O'Hara, who, along with her husband Ryan, owns Big Spoon Creamery's 3 Alabama ice cream shops. Those spring days spent outdoors in the South are such a beautiful core memory, and I have loved the smell and the flavor of honeysuckle from that moment. Honeysuckle grows wild across the region. Japanese honeysuckle, her favorite for ice cream, is one of the most prevalent varieties. The blooms start appearing on bushes in the spring and stick around until they burn out in the summer heat. At Big Spoon, the couple focuses on taking what they get fresh from farmers or forage themselves, in the case of honeysuckle, to churn into ice cream or sorbet. The key to capturing the flower's essence is to steep the cream's base. The white floral notes are similar to a gardenia and add great complexity and depth of flavor, O'Hara says. It is the perfect scoop on a southern spring day. When harvesting honeysuckle, pinch off just the blossom, not the leaves, and be sure to get the entire bud because the nectar's at the bottom of the flower. For maximum flower power, steep the blooms the same day that you pick them. You will need an ice cream maker, but O'Hara's home version of the recipe is surprisingly simple. Making ice cream at home doesn't have to be overly complicated, she says. It's worth the time and effort, and it's a great family activity, using an ingredient that might be growing in your own backyard. That's all the time we have today for Southern Magazines. The program will rebroadcast on Sunday at 10:30 p.m. and may be accessed at www.virginiavoice.org. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Jane Clark for Virginia Voice.